Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition, Livingston Post writer Buddy Morehouse and Vice President Stephanie Van Covering of Resch Strategies discuss if Michigan's new Republican Party needs Mike Rogers more than he needs them. Also, City of Detroit Chief Financial Officer Jay Rising gives MERS a rundown of the city's proposed land value tax plan, which aims to end a culture of property owners feeling incentivized to let things become blighted. And Democratic 2024 presidential candidate Marianne Williamson talks with the team on September 9th, saying it won't surprise her or anyone else if President Joe Biden is not her primary opponent. Now, here's MERS reporter Samantha Schreiber, MERS publisher John Rurink, the boss, and editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. As Mark indicated, we'll be getting into Detroit's land value tax plan today. But for now, I will feel like I can confidently say, per usual now, that we are starting with another special roundtable discussion this morning. And my post-Labor Day cold that I'm sure I've been alarming a lot of interviewees with is somewhat over, maybe. How about you all? Did anyone else get sick after Labor Day, or is it just me?
Just you, Sammy.
Yeah.
All good.
Ah, the universe. The universe did me dirty. We are joined by Buddy Morehouse, although Buddy is currently the Vice President of Public Relations and Media for the Michigan Association of Public School Academies. He is additionally joining us today as the past editor of the Livingston County Press and Argus, and as a current writer for the Livingston Post. Hey, Buddy, how are you doing?
Great to be here. Wonderful.
Also, we are here with Stephanie Van Covering. Did I pronounce your name right, Stephanie?
Yes, you did. Nice job.
A vice president for Resch Strategies, the Lansing-based public relations and public affairs firm. Furthermore, we have MERS publisher John Rurink, the boss. In the middle of last week, former U.S. House member Mike Rogers announced he was running for the U.S. Senate in 2024, officially launching his bid with an ad highlighting his time chairing the U.S. House Intelligence Committee and how he exited politics to help develop cybersecurity companies to combat foreign threats, the biggest name being dropped, China. And now he's on the road. So what do you all think of these early travel days of Mike Rogers' campaign? And how does this shift the stage of the U.S. Senate race that pundits already can't seem to get enough of? I'll start with you, Buddy, since you used to cover him so closely in Livingston County.
Yeah, it's been fascinating to watch. This announcement was kind of like the most anticlimactic thing ever, because we knew that Mike was going to be getting into the race. It was just a matter of when. And yeah, in Livingston County, I've been covering him since he first ran for the state Senate in the early 90s. And we've, at least in Livingston County, of the politicians that have come out of there, we've never had a more popular politician or one that's been a better campaigner. And I think that the Mike that we saw starting in the 1990s, when he was elected to the state Senate at the age of, I think it was 32, at that time, is not surprising to see the way he's approached his campaign so far. He is just an absolute dynamo on the campaign trail. And, you know, just following his Twitter and where he's at every day, it kind of seems like he's been doing the same thing. He's not getting into this slowly.
I want to bring this up to you, John, because last week we had our House reporter, Danny, who went to go visit Mike. She said, you know, being a reporter in 2023, you're kind of used to going to press election related events where they kind of look at you and say, oh, don't you know that they're going to come for your head first when the revolution happens, to members of the media. But with Mike Rogers, she said, oh, patted me on the shoulder and said, thanks for coming. And I'm just so not used to this excitement and warmth toward the media. And what are kind of your thoughts about this return to old fashioned media relations, if I can describe it as that?
Well, if anybody can do the retail politics involved in a statewide primary, it's probably Mike Rogers. The thing that I'm going to be really interested in watching is, how does he interface with what is now the Michigan Republican Party? The grassroots activists that now control the party are very different than the grassroots activists that he was working with when he last toyed with a statewide run for governor, I believe it was. So it's going to be interesting to see how that interfaces and what it means to his campaign. I'd love to hear both our guests' response to how they see Mike Rogers interfacing with this new Republican Party.
What are some of your early thoughts on this, Stephanie?
I think that we're lucky in many respects in Michigan to be able to have a Senate race where both of the candidates are very knowledgeable, experienced, well-spoken. You know, that's big. As far as the grassroots, you know, I've been thinking a lot about that and thinking about, I don't think the party has changed this much in so short a time, maybe in its history. You know, traditionally, the Republican has been identified as the middle to upper class, you know, white male, business owner, kind of doing the thing. And since 2016, I think you've seen a bigger engagement from a broader cross-section of people. And the grassroots have really driven the party in a big direction. Some of the big contributors that have historically controlled the direction of Michigan politics have left. And so you have a less affluent party, and I mean party proper. So the resources are less, the participation is a little bit wonky. And I think that the environment that Mike Rogers left is not the environment that he's entering back into. And I think he's going to have to really make some transitions. But I think there's also an opportunity here to sort of school the party and the grassroots and how you win a seat and get the job done.
A big question I've been having, when you look at the new Michigan Republican Party, how they've been reported as locking themselves into a hardcore box that's stuck on 2020 without a serious mobilization game for elections, could they need someone like Mike Rogers more than he actually needs them?
Absolutely. Mike's a dream candidate for the current Republican Party. He gives them credibility. He gives them a candidate that shows that he is not afraid to get into the race, even with the current Republican Party the way that it is. I think that he is everything that they could possibly ask for. It's going to be, and first of all, I want to say I totally agree with Stephanie that if it ends up being Mike Rogers and Alyssa Slotkin as the two candidates in the end, that is like a dream matchup for Michigan. I don't know if we've ever had two more qualified candidates for a statewide election than the two of them. So, you know, for everyone that bemoans the fact that we can't get smart, intelligent, qualified people to run for office, this is like a dream matchup for the state of Michigan. But it is the dynamics of now Mike and the current Republican Party being so different than when he left. That's going to be a fascinating aspect of this campaign.
From a fundraising position, don't you think Mike Rogers certainly has the capability to raise his own money statewide, but he's also going to be able to raise a lot of money from the traditional Republican sources, the chambers of commerce, the business community. DC is going to be backing him wholly. That's a great opportunity for them if they can pick up Debbie Stabenow's seat. So from that standpoint, he doesn't really need the Michigan Republican Party, but it's still going to be interesting to see where they rub, because they're going to rub.
They absolutely are. I think that at this point, the party, the statewide party, really doesn't know who it is yet. There are a lot of people who have traditionally identified as Republicans that are not comfortable doing so in today's environment. And there are a lot of people who are new Republicans that are looking for that magic way forward. And so I think Mike Rogers has a lot to offer them in terms of schooling them. And then helping to organize them a little bit better than I think they've been organized to date.
Going to be interesting, too, to see how much of his campaign apparatus is still around from 2014, last time that he ran, whatever it was, last time that he was in an election there, because he's never lost an election going all the way back to his state Senate days. Neither has Alyssa Slotkin ever lost an election. So he's somebody who knows how to run a campaign. If he can get the band back together, then it's going to be he's definitely going to be a factor in the election.
I just can't help but feel like we're seeing candidates place themselves into their own separate individual orbits. You have the state party, Donald Trump, 2020, and that is in one orbit. And then you have Mike Rogers, who's in his own kind of ecosystem. And then you have House Republican and State House Republican candidates that are now realigning themselves of Rick Snyder and the business class donor entourage that he had when he was running for governor. And I just wonder, at what point do all of these different orbits collide?
I think that really remains to be seen. I think that who was it? Ronald Reagan used to talk about the big tent. We have a very big tent, and that tent is starting to move into its own corners. And the impact on all of these races, you're going to see a tremendous diversity in candidates. And I think that the idea that we're going to appeal to the undecided swing voter is one that is not yet well understood by some of the new players in the party. So I think some of the more experienced leadership has an opportunity to sort of step in here and say, yeah, this is how politics happens. This is how institutional memory works. And this is what we all need to be doing. And we're not there.
I think a lot of what we've seen early with Mike's campaign, too, is that he is going to run his own campaign, and it's not going to he's not going to be following the lead of not only the state Republican Party, but what's going on in some of the other House races in the state. The things that he's going to talk about are going to be the things that he wants to talk about. He's not getting into a lot of the hot button issues and a lot of the social issues that other candidates are talking about. Talking about national security and the economy. And he's going to, you know, continue to talk about those things, I think, through the campaign. He started right out of the gate. He's not going with whatever the trendy hot button topics are right now. He's talking about his issues.
And those are the really important ones, right, buddy? I mean,
right.
That's where it's at. We've got threats looming from China, which basically almost has set a date for our next war. And we are looking at all of that with an eye to the public mood is going to turn international and start to feel more concerned about it, U.S. security than it has. And so Mike Rogers is kind of the perfect candidate at the perfect time for those kinds of things.
I was just going to say I think the kind of vibe that Mike is giving is that there's some really serious things that we need to deal with, and we need an adult in the room to handle these. And I've been there, I've done that. You know, I'm your person to handle this.
For the sake of time, I'm going to make this a speed round question. Previous Detroit Police Chief James Craig, a disqualified 2022 gubernatorial candidate due to fraudulent signatures significantly diluting his candidate petition, now has 32 days to announce his decision to run for the U.S. Senate based on a deadline he gave to himself last month. Are you all taking this seriously?
Every candidate makes a difference, even if it's splitting votes. But I think in terms of a Rogers-Slotkin matchup, that's the one I want to see.
How about you, buddy?
He obviously, the first thing he needs to do is get on the ballot this time around. The polling I've seen, he polls usually really well in a general election setting. He's got a good name ID, but he doesn't have anywhere near the apparatus that Mike Rogers does to be able to run a serious campaign.
I'm taking him seriously in terms of that he certainly has enough name identification to get in. He probably has enough name identification to raise the money, but I still think he's going to be outmuscled by Mike Rogers and the resources that are going to come in. And you know, I don't know how Washington Republicans make their decision about who they're going to back, but I suspect that they may have already made their decision. I could be wrong, and that's going to be a big factor.
I do want to take a policy pivot. It's September. Lawmakers returned to Lansing for session last Wednesday. As people who work in policy, what are you zooming in on most this month?
I'll go first. What was interesting when the governor outlined her priorities for the fall, she didn't talk about education at all as one of the four areas that she was going to concentrate on. I know there are people in the legislature that want to handle some issues. So I think what's going to be interesting is anything related to education policy that is going to be the priority of someone in the legislature, but maybe not the priority of the governor, will be really fascinating to see.
Yeah, we're leaning in on, we expect to see a lot of movement on energy and healthcare. And so we're really trying to lean in on that. We're also seeing that a lot of folks that we work with are starting to try to lay the groundwork for the fiscal 25 budget. because that's being developed in the executive branch, obviously later this fall. I am going to express some frustration. I think that by having this shortened fall session period, that we are going to end up with some pretty rocky policy outcomes. I think anytime you try to push things through at a high rate of speed without a tremendous amount of public input, and some of these bills are pretty darn massive, I think that you end up with a little bit of, it doesn't do good service to the people of Michigan. And so I really believe that I would rather see them take their time and do it right and get the amount of input that's needed. That said, you know, we're running at full speed and ready to match whatever pace the legislature sets.
I can't help but feel that when you put yourself in a rush situation, that's when infighting takes place. Kind of like that family that's running late for vacation and they all just start screaming at each other.
Right. Yeah. And there's no margins for error on the governor's side or on the Democrat side. So they need everybody to agree that, oh, yeah, we need to tackle this right now. If you get a few people that say, no, this doesn't need to be our issue right now, we need to wait until the spring, then nothing's going to happen.
Yeah. And there are even more interesting politics, I think, involved. There are a couple of bills, particularly with healthcare access, that the governor seemed to push on a little bit. And I think that is going to position her a little bit sideways with the Blues. And that's going to be a fascinating set of politics to observe. Looking forward to that. Not because I have an objective, just because I'm a nerd.
Aren't we all?
I hear there's a lot of talk about. So one thing I did notice, I was trying to type in the Michigan legislative website today. And when you type in my legislature in a Google search box, when you see your results, one of the first things that pops up is a sponsored site that I still have not been able to get into, talking about the prescription drug affordability legislation. And basically that this would be disastrous, watch out, oppose it. And I think already kind of seeing the most, I would say, out of all of these various what's next packages, I have seen much more of a aggressive opposition effort when it comes to this drug affordability board.
I think anytime you start talking healthcare, you get some really, really, really aggressive positioning. It's so core to Michigan families. And it's like education. People dig in hard and they dig in fast. And this is something that really, really, really matters. And so I think it's going to be fascinating. And especially, I think part of the reason we're seeing these high levels of aggression is because of the fall. People have set, organizations have set objectives. I need my bill out by the end of fall. And whether that's, you know, October 15th or November 9th or November 2nd or whatever it is that we're hearing, you know, we're going to be drinking from a fire hose, and it's going to be very, very brutal, I think.
Well, I'm a fellow nerd, Stephanie, and I love covering the health policy committees in the legislature. But one thing I noticed very early on in my journalism career is that these bills and health policy are so significant, but they take forever to get completed, that you can spend 3 months with the committee still hearing testimony on potentially just two bills. And that is one thing, when I see the presence of health policy in the What's Next address, I'm like, wait a second, getting something done in 2 months.
It's ambitious, to say the very, very least.
So I do want to talk about a huge and very unfortunate story in the headlines this week, which is from Michigan State University, where it was recently learned that football coach Mel Tucker continued his role in the program for 10 months following a sexual harassment complaint made against him. The Detroit News learned that half of the 8-member MSU Board of Trustees learned about the allegations and investigation hours before Tucker was suspended. Is there a legislative antidote to this? As the world places this situation under a political limelight, will there be a call for more policy related to sexual harassment investigations and repercussions? Will there be a call for transparency reform for public universities? Where do we go from here?
I think there will be just because that tends to be what the legislature does when something like this happens. And you look at how quickly they reacted after the shooting in February. But I have a daughter who attends Michigan State. She's a sophomore there now, and seeing the troubling lack of transparency and accountability that happened in this case just in the last 24 hours or so is very troubling. You know, as a parent and as just residents of the state of Michigan, we deserve a lot better than we've been getting with this. So I don't know what solution will be, what that possible legislative solution will be, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if they try to come up with some way to help tackle this.
The press conference yesterday bothered me a good deal. It seemed unresponsive to many requests, at many questions. And the biggest one of which is, why did it take so long to do anything, to suspend Coach Tucker and to address these issues? And later on, I saw somebody saying that it was really Title IX, that is supposed to be, the investigation is trauma-informed and it's supposed to be completely confidential. And that's great. But they could have said that at the press conference. Mm-hmm. They could have explained the process and the laws that they're operating under. If there were a policy solution, it would probably be at the federal level to look at Title IX, because if you have somebody who's truly, truly dangerous, and they're on campus for an extra 8, 10, 12 months, there's a lot that could happen. And so that would be about the only real legislative policy solution that I could see. But I do think that MSU has a lot to answer for. I think their PR effort has been difficult here. And I feel for the folks that are trying to do it, because it sounds like they're operating in a system where there are a lot of folks that are not eager to move quickly. And sometimes you just have to.
Yep. And we've talked about it during our meeting this morning. I'm still curious, if you think about MSU, they have an interim president. They struggled with the Larry Nassar issue and got burnt many different ways about how they handled that. I'm just curious and I don't know that much about Title IX and what restrictions go into place about an investigation, who knows what. But if that was the case, they really should have explained with a sheet almost and handed out to reporters, this is how Title IX works. This is what we did. This is why nobody knew about it until the newspaper broke the story, because we have a claimant and we have the coach, and we're trying to respect both and resolve it through the proper Title IX procedure. Now, I don't know if that's the case, but clearly I agree with you, Stephanie. I think MSU really missed a public relations opportunity to really explain the process, why it was handled the way it was, why we're where we're at today, and why the suspension now.
Do you guys think he keeps his job in any way, shape, or form? Is it possible?
No.
No way at all. There's no way he can come back and be the coach of that team. I've seen people that are a lot closer to the situation than I am are saying that too, but there's no way that he'll come back.
I just feel like here you have a community of people that are still very much healing from Larry Nassar. And where do you all go from here? And I think that's a big question that I always ask, is where do you all go from here? And is there a way to contribute to that healing process when mistrust is at an all-time high?
Yeah, there's so many facets to it. There's the culture of the school, and to what role does that play in anything that happens there? But I think more importantly, it gets to what you were talking about, Stephanie, is the response to it. The one thing that MSU can control is how they respond to incidents that happen. When they first find out about them, and how they notify people, and then, you know, all the way up until they decide to take action on it. That's the one thing that they can control. It just seems like in a lot of these situations, they've been missing.
Yeah, this one also was very confusing to me, reading the USA Today coverage of it, because without going into excruciating detail, if somebody does something inappropriate on the phone with me, my first response is to hang up and not spend 36 minutes on the call. And so that there's a bit of he said, she said here that is really murky. And I think that MSU does have a responsibility to sort that out thoughtfully. I also thought that texts were never fully deleted. Wasn't it when Kilpatrick had the affair with that chief of staff? I think they were able to go back through the phone company and get those mm-hmm. those texts. So I think this is a situation that very much continues to unfold. And so my instinct, if I were advising MSU, if I were advising the state legislature, would be not to rush to judgment, to let things play out, but to use the principle of transparency to say, okay, you know, it's Friday. Here's what's happened this week, and here's what our next steps are. And I feel like that's really something that's been missing.
It's probably also worth noting that the USA Today coverage noted that the special independent investigator that university hired out of Ann Arbor, she submitted a report, but she didn't make a finding. She didn't point it either. She didn't point that this, yes, this is a true thing. That I mean, she really didn't come to any conclusions other than restating the facts of the case, which I found interesting. I don't know how that plays into it. Like I said, I'm not an expert in Title IX investigations, but I wonder how much that played into the university's sort of bumbling of what do we do with this?
This is definitely going to be a story that the state maintains, continues to be zoomed in on. But unfortunately, we are out of time with our roundtable discussion. Stephanie Vancouvering and Buddy Morehouse, and obviously John the Boss, thank you all so much for joining this and joining me this morning for our MERS Monday roundtable discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
With us today is Jay Rising, the City of Detroit's Chief Financial Officer. Before being formally appointed as the city CFO in 2021, Mr. Rising has served as Governor Gretchen Whitmer's Cabinet Secretary, as past Governor Jennifer Granholm's State Treasurer, and as previous Governor Jane Blanchard's Deputy State Treasurer. Jay is specifically with us today to discuss Detroit's land value tax plan, which requires approval from the state legislature to be placed on the ballot during the 2024 presidential primary election for Detroiters, where they'll decide to cut tax mills on buildings by 14 mills and to double taxes on land, especially parking lots, scrap yards, and vacant spaces. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jay. As a budget-making expert, can you tell us why you view this plan as vital for improving the quality of life in Detroit?
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. So what we're dealing with in Detroit is a substantial amount of land speculation and vacant properties. And so what we designed is a plan to create some permanent property tax relief for people who live here by lowering millage rates and the effective millage rate on your property. We did that through exempting your property from Detroit's taxes up to 14 mills and replacing that with a tax on the land value of property. As homeowners, your land is a small proportion, 3-4% of most homeowners, of the value of your property. So you'll see a tax cut for 97% of the folks in Detroit. For the other 3%, we've guaranteed that no one will go up. And we think by doing this, this both attracts people to the city so that when you're making this choice of where do I want to build or where do I want to live, taxes are not an impediment. There's no barriers to entry for the city anymore. And making a decision about whether I want to move, you're not moving because of tax reasons. We also want to just make this permanent for developers, for everyone else, so that you don't have to know the system to get your tax abatement to get to build in Detroit to do something. You've got a system which is automatically there for you. You know, and finally, there's an objective of making sure that the speculative use of property is not rewarded. Now it's better off to let your property go blight because it causes your assessment to keep coming down so far. And then you pay, it may be a high millage rate, but of no value. So the cost of having blighted properties will go up in the city. The cost of having unproductive use of lands cut is going to go up in the city. And that hopefully will spur redevelopment and encourage people to use the property in a more productive way.
So where did this idea come from, Jay?
Well, it's not new. I mean, it's been all talked about for decades.
Pennsylvania, for the city of Detroit?
Well, actually, yeah. There have been folks in the past who have suggested this and talked about it. I think the mayor in his Mackinac speech, you know, put a clip out from Coleman Young who was suggesting that something like this. It's just, there's been a complexity of this plan has been how to do this under Michigan's Constitution. And so we've developed a way which we think is a replacement tax rather than a split value tax. Because in Michigan, what I can't do is have one value percentage I'm taxing on for land, another value for improvements. So what I really had to do was to exempt the property from collection of certain taxes and replace it with the tax on land.
How did this get on Mayor Duggan's A-list as something he really wanted to get done?
Well, I think he recognized pretty quickly that all his efforts, he spent 10 years now looking for ways to reduce blight in the city. And part of that is to make it more attractive to invest in, as well as make it more expensive not to invest. So I think when he started understanding how do we design this in a way to do that, got more and more comfortable with the idea and really came up with a lot of the components of this plan.
Now, I kind of want to dive into some of the grassroots concerns about this plan. Sure. Now, there are groups like the Coalition for Property Tax Justice in Detroit, which have stated that although they're not completely opposed to the plan, there needs to be ordinances that purges out over-assessments affecting Detroit homeowners. Specifically, the coalition claims that since 2009, inflated tax bills in the city have displaced more than 100,000 Detroiters, and overtaxing has equaled up to $600 million from 2010 to 2016. What is your take on the coalition's numbers and this belief that the plan does not protect from over-assessments?
Well, I'm not going to argue with the coalition that 2007 to 2016, the assessment practices in Detroit were not good. I think when the mayor came in, he recognized that also and did a reassessment of the city. What I do argue about is whether or not that continues. I think we have good assessments. We have our assessments reviewed each year by the State Tax Commission. I think our assessments are accurate reflection of values in the city. Now, are we right in every single case? No city is. Do we give people the opportunity to come and contest their assessment? We do. And we do the fairly liberally and make changes to make sure the assessments are right. But I think our assessment practices have improved dramatically since 2009 and through 2016 when we did the reassessment. So I don't disagree that there were inequities in the assessments back prior to Mayor Duggan's tenure, but I think we've corrected those. That doesn't mean that some of the ideas of the coalition regarding especially how people should be informed of their taxes and how their taxes work and of what their rights of appeal should be shouldn't be implemented. But I don't think there are the issues with current assessments that I don't see the same issues the coalition does. And I also think, and I think the coalition agrees, that the coalition has said they aren't diminishing this proposal. They believe in this proposal. They just want to be recognized their issues first. I think we can do both things at the same time. If they have issues which we legally address, we can seek to do that. And we've been working with the Council President's office to do that also.
So just to confirm, as of right now, this proposal, this tax plan that you have, it's supposed to be a standalone solution? Or do you think there could be room for amendments or further changes as we move forward with what the legislation decides to do, the legislature?
Well, I think the legislature needs to look at it and talk about it and see how it works. What we made it as is a local option. Every community can choose whether to come in. They don't have to use this plan if they don't want to. And within the plan itself, there are decisions you can make to make it fit your city better. You don't have to put your whole city operating budget on. You don't have to. You can put half of or more into the plan and replace half the taxes. There's options to have other local units to come in if they would like to. But every local unit will make their own decisions. So I think it's structured in a way to have people have decisions. If the legislature points out flaws or wants enhancements, we're open to this. We'd just like to be able to enact it in a way that's best for the city of Detroit also.
Jay, this is supposed to be revenue neutral, correct?
It will be revenue neutral in the first year.
And then what happens after that?
It all depends on whether or not the land values grow slower or faster than the improvement values. So if improvement values take off by this and lots of people are moving into the city and land values are fairly stable or moderate growth, since I'm only taxing land values, I may not get all the value of my exempted mills on those improvements that were being made, all the new buildings and new additions. So that may create a gap of what I could have gotten. But the question is a but-for question. Would I have gotten those things if I didn't do this? So revenue neutral is in the eyes of the beholder in a way. We made sure that we start off revenue neutral. We're encouraged folks to use the plan, develop your property, provide more jobs through how you're developing this. And hopefully we'll make up on the income tax side of the equation what we may forego on the property tax side.
What municipalities can you point to that actually do something like this? And what did you learn from looking at that? Because I hear this is a pretty novel concept.
I think it's novel in the design. Pennsylvania has had a number of communities who developed and used a land tax, or what they call their split tax system, which is to the taxpayer the same thing. The difference in there and what caused a little consternation in Pennsylvania was that it wasn't a replacement. It was an additional tax. So it was a different environment. You know, we're talking about this additional tax and bringing extra revenues. And so some cities decided to cancel it after they started it. For us, it's a replacement tax. It's intentionally meant to lower residential taxes and tax instead land, which is not being put in productive use.
So when it comes to parking lot owners and those owning scrapyards and non-utilized buildings, how much are they paying now and how much would they be paying under this plan?
Well, I can't tell you specifics about it. I mean, everyone's different. What I can tell you is you think about it like this. It's that if your property is in a place where the land is highly valued, you're likely going to see a tax increase. Now, we've tried to put some credits that you can adopt inside the plan so that no one who's invested in a property and have improvements more than 40% of the value could see a tax increase by more than 20%. But if you're just a parking lot, you know, basic improvements are just asphalt, if that, in a little guards house, you're likely to see an increase wherever you may be. But in general, it's determined by where your property is and how much property you have as compared to the buildings on it. The more property you have in terms of value as compared to the buildings on it, the more likely you're going to see an increase.
You know, when you think about these vacant areas and these vacant abandoned buildings or parking lots, it seems that there's also a safety and an environmental risk of having them around and not actually contributing or having any operations or safety measures going on. Is that an accurate observation to make?
Well, I can't tell that. I think blighted property is always, you know, unoccupied blighted property is often a safety risk. Because it's hazardous to people who are living nearby, anyone who tried to enter it. I think there's a risk of dumping on vacant property, which I think is environmental issues. Making that more expensive is a good thing. You know, that's what we're trying to do in the proposal, is make people make choices, you know, based on what the best use of the property could be, rather than I'm just going to warehouse it for 20 years and see what may happen in my district with this area.
Jay, obviously you have experience as being the state treasurer for the state of Michigan. Tell me what the experience has been like as being the CFO for the city of Detroit. What's been different? What's been striking to you as you've done this role compared to your role as the treasurer for the state of Michigan?
Well, I think it's a different role. I mean, in treasurer, you're dealing with the financial side of the equation, the debt side of the equation, the local government supervision of property taxes side of the equation. And the budget office takes care of the budget and develops that, the spending plan. As CFO of the city, you're doing both things. You're balancing the spending and the revenue collection.
And talk about the challenge in balancing the books for the city of Detroit, just in general, given their past issues with bankruptcy and coming out of bankruptcy.
Well, I've been really lucky because I have a really strong team, and I have people who have come into the city since bankruptcy really committed to that never happening again. And so, if anything, we may err on the side of conservatism. We are very cautious of not overstating our revenues and putting us in a position where we're spending money that we can't afford. So we're careful. It's been 10 years now. Questions about opening up some of the retirement benefits are starting to appear. Because under the bankruptcy order, we couldn't do anything for 10 years, but now we can do things in terms of retirement benefits. But we're trying to approach this very cautiously so that we are only doing what we can afford.
And then as far as the books for the city of Detroit, how is the city's financial picture? How would you describe it?
Ascending.
Ascending?
Yes. I mean, we have gotten upgrades 3 times since I've been here in the last 2 years. from the rating agencies. We're one small half a notch below investment grade, which I hope that will resolve itself next year. I think it's a lot easier to drop in ratings than go up in ratings, especially for a city which was bankrupt. And I think their agencies are very cautious. But we sold debt twice since I've been here and received very, very favorable rates. So I think the world views this as an investment grade credit.
So obviously Detroit acquired some budget and many budget items in this past fiscal year, 2024 budget. When you think about the state level and how budget decisions are being made, do you kind of wish that there was more transparency, or would you have your own transparency proposals so that way the city of Detroit isn't just kind of waiting at the edge of its seat to see what it's actually going to get?
I think like everyone, we're engaged in the process. It's up to the legislature to decide how many hearings they have and what they discuss in public. We tried to give pretty openly and openly discuss what we're seeking, whether it's revenue sharing for public safety or stormwater systems or basement backup funding or lead abatement, home repairs. I mean, we have our list we go to, and everyone has their list. I mean, I think Detroit has been treated very fairly by the legislature. We hope to continue to make our case for some of the revenue sharing for public safety. And I think a lot of money went to a lot of organizations and institutions which are located in the city, which helps us indirectly, even though we don't get the money directly.
So was there anything in the fiscal year 2024 budget that surprised you?
I can't, not off the top of my head, I can't say that.
To change the subject here a second, what's it like to work for Mayor Mike Duggan?
Well, I have a long history.
Tell me about that. I wasn't familiar with that.
So I met Mayor when he was at Treasury under Blanchard. He was at Wayne County as a deputy county executive, and the county was in serious fiscal constraints, in part a lot to the state's requirement that it fund indigent health care. So we started working together back then on indigent health care issues. And how to finance the city's deficit, much of which money was owed to the state of Michigan. So we built together a recovery plan for the county. So we've been friends and known each other ever since the mid-80s. And when I was practicing law in the 90s, I had the opportunity to work for him when he was a client on a number of issues and do some really important things from Tiger Stadium to the airport. And then being state treasurer, and then middle of my tenure as state treasurer, he called up and said, do you want to be CFO of DMC? So I joined him at Detroit Medical Center for 8 years. Then I basically retired, and then I retired again. Then he called me again.
He doesn't want you to retire, huh?
No, he has that way. He thinks I need to work more.
So it's really kind of out of loyalty and friendship that you said yes.
Well, more than that, you know, in some ways it sounds corny, but everything I've done in my career has led to this job. Whether it's being state treasurer or a public finance attorney or being CFO at the DMC, I've taken all these little pieces of it and now I do it all at one place. So that's the enjoyable thing about it. As well as I'm working for a city who's, as I say, ascending. I mean, we are, every year we do better. And it's just, I like the challenge of improving it year over year and making sure our books are balanced.
Now, I do want to bring this conversation full circle as we're near the end here, back to the land value tax plan. Now, at the end of the day, once it gets authorized by the legislature, it is up to the Detroit voters to decide if they want it or not. Are you concerned about voter turnout in that primary election? Are you concerned about people just not really knowing and not just feeling that excitement to show up to the polls for this?
I hope this has people come to the polls. They're coming to vote whether or not they want a tax cut. And if anything, I hope it gets more people at the polls. I think this will be a driver in a presidential election, a primary election, which won't have as much of a contested race. I'm excited for it to be in February. We needed to be in February to make sure we meet our deadlines. But I think this is an opportunity for people who understand there's a ballot question with the presidential primary and having an opportunity to vote on something important for them.
So here's my question for you, Jay. What happens if that February presidential primary does not happen and we end up having the March 11th primary? What happens to this plan?
State law requires us to put it on a a regularly scheduled election, so we will have to force it into another primary. If it is in March, we'll wait a couple of weeks to do that. That will make a difference. We're hopeful that it's in February. That gives us time to have plenty of time to do this still. And what we don't want to do is delay it past till the August primary. So at some time in the spring, I'm sure we're going to see this on the ballot.
No, definitely. Well, thank you so much, Jay Rising, for joining us on today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast to talk about Detroit's land value tax plan. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Today is Marianne Williamson, a spiritual author and lecturer who is currently running as a 2024 Democratic presidential candidate. Thank you so much for joining us today, Marianne.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to ask, out of genuine curiosity for myself, do you prefer being called a spiritual author or a self-help author by the media? Because I feel like there's a lot of cynicism and eye rolling that takes place when people think of like self-help books and brands and other things.
Absolutely. Self-help author is just the latest way to deride and mock what I've given my life to for the last 40 years. I noticed that self-help moniker that's been ascribed to me during this campaign. It's simply a way to diminish my work. So, and not, by the way, that I don't mean to be insulting self-help authors. It's just that I don't think that it's an accurate description of my work. And spiritual author, you know, listen, I'm an author. Most people who write books like I do would simply be called an author. I write about spiritual topics, and I've also written a couple of political books as well.
So I know that according to your website, your advocacy journey really kicked off during the AIDS epidemic when you were giving lectures in Los Angeles on the A Course in Miracles spiritual self-study program. And started offering support groups and meditation classes and free meals to those being impacted by the epidemic and attacks against the gay community. However, I did see that you started your spiritual career here in Michigan, in Warren specifically. Can you tell us more about how much time you've spent here in the state?
I lived here for 8 years. I started lecturing in 1983 in Los Angeles, and I didn't move to Michigan until I think 1998. And I went to be the interim minister, was supposed to be the interim minister at what was then called the Church of Today. And then we called Renaissance Unity, a non-denominational spiritual center in Warren. And I was there for 6 years. And I raised my daughter here. And so obviously that 8 years has a big piece of my heart.
And were you in Warren for all 8 years then?
No, I lived in Grosse Pointe. The Church of Today was located in Warren. And my daughter was, I think, 8 years old, I mean, when we moved here. And we left when she was 16.
What are some of your best memories of Michigan?
Well, my best memories of Michigan actually have to do with my daughter. My daughter says she's 33 years old today. And she says, Mommy, I had a happy childhood in Michigan. I think my best memories were, it's a good place to raise a child. There was a sense of safety and community and caring and values and things that you want your child to be raised around. And she was exposed to diversity, cultural diversity, racial diversity. So I think that gave her a very positive start in life. The church experience, it was through that I, first of all, met some wonderful people that will be lifelong friends, some of whom I met today. I saw again today, I mean, at Nandy's Cafe. I made lifelong friends here, and I learned a lot. You know, it was a multiracial, multicultural, multiethnic church, or it ended up being when I was on the pulpit. It had not been before. I learned some things viscerally here in Detroit that I knew intellectually, but which entered me at a deeper level being here, and that are very core to what I'm doing now, whether it has to do with poverty, whether it has to do with race, racial reconciliation, criminal injustice, how America really works on some very raw levels. I learned living here. So when you say, what are my best memories? I can't say all those were some of my most pleasant memories, but I also realized that they actually were some of my best memories. Some things got seared onto my heart living here that are very much core to my campaign for president, about the despair, the systemic inequities, how difficult it is for people who are simply living to do the right thing, trying to do the right thing, raising their children well, but for whom the system is simply rigged. They don't have health care. They don't have paid family leave. They don't have child care. They don't have a way to send their kids to college. They're living with these college loan debts. They don't have a place to live. They don't have a guaranteed living wage. And what I met in Detroit working at that church were so many people whose lives were ravaged by many of the factors I just mentioned, and who are such good people, trying to do the right thing, raising their children so well, whose children have the same potential as the children anywhere else. And I saw how America works when I lived here. And I promised myself, you know, I was the spiritual leader at that church. It was a non-denominational church, and I'm Jewish, so we talked about it in non-denominational ways. And I remember some of the people who I met during that time who looked at me in hopes that maybe I could help with this situation or that situation. And I promised myself that if I was ever in a position to do that, I would.
I want to dive a bit into the 2024 presidential race right now. There is a lot of conversation about a switcheroo occurring ahead of the 2024 elections, that Joe Biden or Kamala Harris are going to get switched out for a prominent Democratic leader in another state. And that's something that gets talked a lot about here in Michigan. Will there be a switcheroo between Biden and Gretchen Whitmer? Do you personally believe in those theories? And does that drive you at all with being involved in this race?
I think there's clearly scuttlebutt. Something has changed over the last 2 or 3 weeks. Before 2 or 3 weeks ago, you simply were not allowed to mention that Joe Biden might be a weak candidate. It was like blasphemous to say such a thing. Today, the cat's out of that bag. And when you look at how he is doing in the polls next to someone who is twice impeached and multiple indicted and is still only, you know, in a basic tie, then you don't have to be a political genius to assume there might be a problem here. So, yes, it's, you know, once it hits MSNBC, once it hits the Morning Joe, you know that the mainstream beltway conversation has gone there. You can almost feel it in the air. Will it be Gavin Newsom? Will it be Gretchen Whitmer? Will it be Pritzker? Who will it be? Will it be Pete? It will be Kamala. It's the same old horse race conversation. So, yes, I don't think any of us at this point are going to be shocked if sometime in the next few weeks, what you refer to as a switcheroo does occur.
What do you think's going on with Joe Biden in the polls? I mean, we just saw something earlier that, what, two-thirds of Americans would prefer that somebody else run on the Democratic side. Is it concerns about his health? What do you think it is?
Well, you know, it's a delicate conversation for me because I don't want to sound ageist or mean-spirited, but we all see what we see, and it concerns us when a president makes gaffes that seem related to some level of cognitive decline. We shouldn't have to apologize for concern around that. The presidency is the most stressful job in the world, and we're talking about somebody's ability to handle that at tip-top shape for the next 4 years. So no American should have to apologize for having concerns. My own personal belief, I agree with Franklin Roosevelt, who said that we would not have to worry about a fascist takeover as long as democracy delivered on its promises. And that's the problem for me. The enemy here is not just Donald Trump or someone like him. The enemy is the causal element behind so much human despair in this country that people would even be attracted to an authoritarian or strongman. And to me, that has to do with corporate greed. So even though I do actually appreciate, admire, and respect your governor here, Gretchen Whitmer, who has clearly done some things all of us can admire, there is a status quo political class that is so tied in to subservience and the final analysis, to subservience to corporate power, that they become at least unwitting agents too often of the corporate greed that is the deeper problem. So to me, the way to beat the Democrats, I mean, to beat the Republicans in 2024, is to offer the American people a more compelling vision, a more compelling agenda, a more compelling platform than what the Republicans are offering. And that's why I think that I'm better than any of those pretty much cookie cutter Democratic candidates who would be placed, who would be, you know, proffered by the Democratic elite as the better candidate than Joe Biden.
Would you go on the record with saying that you don't believe that Joe Biden is going to be your primary opponent?
Well, contrary to popular belief, I do not, in fact, have a crystal ball. So I don't know.
It's but it is
anything could happen. You know, yeah, obviously. I mean, this is a very unpredictable moment. It would not surprise me if what you just said comes to pass. Of course, it would not surprise me. I don't think at this point it would surprise anyone.
What issue is do you think has gotten undercovered so far in this 2024 campaign?
Well, it's not undercovered by me, but it's why I'm running, and that is poverty, income inequality, the need for Medicare for all, need for tuition-free college and tech school, the housing crisis, guaranteed living wage. We have a third of America's workers are living on less than $15 an hour, and half of them can't find a place to live. We have 600,000 homeless people. We have 1 in 4 Americans living with a medical debt. We have half of our seniors living at less than $25,000 a year. People are dying deaths of despair in this country. That's what's underplayed. You know, for the Democrats to think that we're going to win in 2024 by saying everything's so good, that runs counter and contrary to the visceral experience of the majority of Americans. What's being undercovered, undertended to, is the suffering of millions and millions and millions of people. And unfortunately, the political status quo has no intention of delivering on genuine economic reform, because to have the kind of fundamental economic reform that we need in this country would undercut the short-term profit maximization goals of the corporate donor class. And that's why we need something completely different, and we need someone to come from outside that system who cuts the cord with that aberrational paradigm.
Politico has really covered your campaign as being in a state of, you know, financial disarray. Is that accurate? And could you give us an update on how you're doing with fundraising for this campaign?
I would not call it financial disarray at all. It's nothing compared to the $25 million ad buy that Biden has, or another opponent of mine who has, you know, huge super PACs run by right-wing billionaires. I don't have any of that. So my campaign is less large, where some people might have 5 people on staff. I'll have 2 people on staff. But my campaign has spirit. My campaign has a joy to it. And my campaign has a level of radical truth-telling about what's really going on in this country that continues to attract audiences and attract support. I wouldn't say we're breaking through, but I would certainly say we're inching forward. And the fact that I don't have greater funds keeps me from building the campaign that enables me to override the invisibilization of such mainstream outlets as MSNBC and CNN. But we're a little engine that could. We're still moving. And I get plenty of enthusiasm from supporters everywhere I go. I was in Nevada this week. I was in Las Vegas this week. I'm in Detroit now. I will be in Ann Arbor tomorrow morning. On Monday, I go to New Hampshire. We're on the move. And people know, both conservatives and liberals, that I'm speaking to something deeper going on here than the same old transactional political conversation. You know, people have asked me, what's different about this time? What's different in you? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say so much that something's different in me, but something's different in the American electorate. When I was running in 2020, among Democratic voters, there was almost a panic. All we want to know is who can get rid of Donald Trump, who can get rid of Donald Trump. Now, in retrospect, we all had a naive belief, certainly a naive hope, that if we just defeated Donald Trump, then America would go back to some level of normalcy. Well, unfortunately, we can all now see that some cat has been let out of the bag. It's a malevolent cat that man let out of the bag. There is no doubt about it, from Nazis to Proud Boys and everything in between. And I want to be careful here. I don't think it's fair to say he let all of that out of the bag, but he stoked some very wildfires. There's no doubt about it. And we've had COVID. So there are all kinds of things that put the American people in a different place. There's a deeper listening that I sense in people, a more expanded understanding, and a lack of innocence. People are not as easily taken in by the same old status quo political conversations that have disappointed us so many times at this point, that my fear is how many people are on the brink of simply giving up. And that's why I think my campaign is important. There is a political realignment going on in this country that I don't think either major political party recognizes, because they are in their own bubble. And that has to do with the fact that people are seeing through what is essentially the ruse of left versus right. The real political dichotomy in this country, the real political dichotomy, is between the powerful and the powerless, between those who have capital and access to further accumulation of capital versus the majority of Americans who are simply struggling to survive. People are getting that. People hear that. And I find them very, very open to someone who's talking about how to fix that.
We appreciate your time, Marianne Williamson. I've just got one more question, and maybe you actually addressed this in your last comments here, but what is keeping you going? Obviously, you're still under 10% in the polls, but what is the drive? What is driving you to continue this campaign and gives you hope that you can still break through here?
Well, first of all, you say I'm under 10, and many I'm at 10. And if you think about the fact that I'm so invisibilized by mainstream media and is still at 10, that's not nothing. And I also remind you that in the latest New York Times poll, which is a gold standard 2 weeks ago, in the group of Gen Z, 18 to 29, I am only 7 points behind the president. The president is at 37, he was at 34, I'm at 27, and Robert Kennedy Jr. at 13. So I contend that if I had the same access to older voters that I have to younger voters, remember they're all on TikTok, so it doesn't cost me money to reach them. If I was able to reach their parents with that much ease, which normally would be the function of the mainstream media, then I think that I would be doing much better. Why is it that when you mentioned my poll numbers, but I assure you my poll numbers are much higher than many of the Republicans who are running, and yet they are on Meet the Press every Sunday. They are covered regularly. They are given CNN town hall. So I'm still in because I see the game that is being played here. And that's exactly what I'm standing up to. If I wake up one morning and I feel that I'm not supposed to be here, then I will stop. But right now, the way people talk to me, the things that people say, and yes, the donations that they send, I am speaking for millions and millions and millions of people who are left out of the normal political conversation, the people who do not have health care, the people who are carrying crippling debt, people who are living lives of despair, their lives are falling apart in this country all around us. We have 20% of Americans for whom the economy is working well, and I'm among them. I'm grateful for that. But 20%, the 20% of us for whom the American economy is working are living on an island surrounded by a sea of vast, filled with vast human despair. That's what I wake up every morning and I speak to, and I will continue as long as my gut and my soul say keep going. And I actually believe that I could be going all the way to the White House.
We are definitely well over 15 minutes here. But with that being said, can I just ask you a quick flash round speed yes or no question real quick before we take off? I am wondering. Yes. Big story in Michigan right now is potentially having an early Democratic presidential primary in February. Is that something you're paying attention to?
Yes.
So does it change? Do you think it really does change Michigan's role here?
Absolutely.
Even with Joe Biden?
Well, once again, there are so many unknowables regarding Joe Biden that you can't let what is happening with Joe Biden either speed you up or slow you down.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Marianne Williamson, for taking time to join us on the MERS Monday podcast while you are in Michigan today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Thank you so much to our morning roundtable participants, Livingston Post writer Buddy Morehouse, the Vice President of Media for the Michigan Association of Public School Academies, and Vice President Stephanie Van Covering of Resch Strategies. Additionally, thank you to Detroit Chief Financial Officer Jay Rising, as well as 2024 Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson. Also, I want to give a tremendous thanks to MERS publisher John Brurink, the boss, and MERS editor Kyle Mullen. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos. Thanks to him for putting this audio together. Additionally, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all of our other podcasts. Until next time, I am Samantha Schreiber. It loves me and I can't let you go. Your handprints on my soul. It's like your eyes are red, it's like your body's gold. You've been calling